с милой шли вдвоем, а фонарики горели. И привидели их на момент притих, и сердца наши замляли. Люди в масках.
Hello and welcome to the SRB podcast, where each week we cover topics relating to Eurasian politics, history, and society. I'm your host, Sean Guillory. One guest today, Elizabeth Wood, on the memory of World War II in Russia. Elizabeth Wood is a professor of history at MIT. She is the author of Performing Justice, Agitation Trials in Early Soviet Russia, and The Baba and the Comrade, Gender and Politics in Revolutionary Russia. Her current work centers on the performance of power under Vladimir Putin in Russia today. May 9th marks the 70th anniversary of the Soviet defeat of Germany in World War II. What is the significance of the war's memory in Russia?
May 9th has become, and World War II, has become one of the most important holidays and one of the most important symbols of modern Russia. And one of the things we probably want to do right at the beginning is think about why that is so important. My sense of it is that the memory of World War II and then the holiday that marks it have become a sacred memory and a sacred event, which marks who is in the nation and who is out of the nation. So for Russians today, it is very much the Great Patriotic War, as Stalin was calling it from the middle of the war. He was already calling it the Great Patriotic War. It's the war of Soviet suffering and redemption. It's the war of the saving of Europe from the Nazis, the evil Nazis, so it becomes a civilizational divide. The heroic Russia, the heroic Soviet Union saves all of Europe from the Nazi bandits who were attacking and destroying civilization. But it's also very important to realize that this is the war that has been positioned as the unifying force, the moment when the whole Soviet Union was unified against the outside invaders. It's portrayed in terms of timeless heroism. It's portrayed, it's ritualized, so it shows the sense of belonging, especially through the St. George's ribbons that Vladimir Putin introduced in 2005. So we get a narrative that's us versus them, us that is united, and us that is capable of suffering and coming through the suffering in a heroic way. So that combination of heroism and suffering has made it the holiday of all holidays. The challenge, of course, is that not everyone in the world sees this holiday in this way. And so one of the things we'll want to talk about is how the Russians suffered. Why is this a kind of a trauma? And then why is it not necessarily understood from the perspective of other nations?
So you've laid out many things that I do indeed want to talk about. And first, let's deal with the trauma aspect, because you know, one of the things that you read, and I read this morning in a comment from in the press from a Russian that says, you know, everyone has family members that were affected by this war in one way or another. So it's a trauma that's felt throughout Russian society and continues to be in the honoring of family members who died or were wounded. And there's no doubt that the memory of the war has had a profound effect on shaping the Russian consciousness. In what way should we view this as a historical trauma?
I think we absolutely have to. One of the things I've been thinking about is the fact that 27 million people died. One of the problems with numbers for all of us, it's hard to grasp what that means. So I started thinking, what does that mean in terms of U.S. cities? So this morning I looked up the populations of U.S. cities in 2013. 27 million dead in the Soviet Union means the top 12 cities in the United States completely obliterated. New York, LA, Chicago, Houston, Philly, Phoenix, etc. So if we think of all of those cities destroyed so that not a single person is alive, that's what 27 million dead is. The way I tell it to my MIT students who love numbers is that the margin of error in the Soviet number is more than all the Allied deaths put together. The U.S. deaths were something like 243,000. Now, that's still a lot of deaths, and we must remember all of the other forces in Europe who died. And with my students, I go through and I say, how many Yugoslav deaths were they? How many Polish deaths were they? How many, you know, we know the 6 million Jews that were killed on the Nazi side. So we've got an enormous number of deaths. But for 27 million to be more than the sum total of all the LA deaths, that's a huge number. Then the other thing to remember, of course, is the sheer length of the front. You know, the Western Front, as it's called in the Soviet Union, or the Eastern Front from the European perspective, was over 2,000 miles long. So that Soviet forces were facing 90% of German military might. There were, in April of 1945, there were 2 million German troops facing 6 million Soviet troops. So one of the things to remember is that all of the numbers in this war are so enormous, they're hard to imagine. 900 days of siege in Leningrad, the Stalingrad battle of, you know, from August 1942 to February 1943, millions more died. So it's an enormous trauma for the Soviet Union, for Russia. But the other thing, I think the other reason that it becomes so important is that the other huge trauma that we don't sufficiently understand in the West is the trauma of 1991 and the breakup of the Soviet Union. So what the return to the war, the Great Patriotic War, does is it brings back to the Soviet Union together. It's the last moment. I would say it this way. It's the earliest moment in Soviet history that the authorities want to deal with. They don't like Leninism. Putin himself has spoken out against 1937 and the traumas of Stalinism. So we get the heroic Stalin, and we get the Soviet Union in the last moment before the Cold War really breaks out in 46, 47, 48. So it's a moment of unity both within the Soviet Union. All the nationalities are there. Everybody's fighting together. It's the greatest extent because by 45 they've taken the Baltics, they've taken Western Ukraine, they've taken you know, the whole of what becomes the full Soviet Union, and it's the moment of greatest unity with the Allies.
This issue of unity, I think, is really important. In particular, the way I see it is that it is the one historical event from the Soviet period that there's basically some kind of societal consensus on. I mean, yeah, you have a lot of debate, of course, in terms of Soviet activities and the intentions and the role of Stalin. But in general, as a unifying force, it does act as a historical period for everyone to kind of come together. And for anyone who's actually been in Russia on May 9th, which I've had the fortunate experience of being, you really get this kind of sense where the society is kind of unified.
That's absolutely right. And the other thing I think is very important is the degree to which it's a show of military might. I'm remembering when you talked about that, I'm remembering being there in 2005, just before the May 9th holiday, and watching the rehearsals with miles of troop carriers and tanks and coming into the city for weeks in advance, and then displaying on Red Square. So that military might, no one's going to take us for granted. No one is going to look down on us. We were the premier military power of the of that war. So I think that it's a militarization of it, as well as the unity and the, and now, of course, added the whole question of patriotism.
So let's kind of put the memory, if we can, in some kind of historical context, because I get the sense that there is a major break in how World War II was memorialized and utilized, both culturally and politically, from the Soviet period and the post-Soviet period. So what kind of continuities and discontinuities exist today, and how the war was memorialized in both societies?
Great point. The cult of World War II really begins in the Brezhnev era. As Nina Tumarkin showed in her book, The Living and the Dead, it wasn't particularly memorialized in the Stalin period. It was after Stalin's death, after Khrushchev, that under Brezhnev it became the great holiday. So there's a kind of continuity of showing might, showing victory, showing redemption through suffering, the narratives, that, and also the other thing is to think about it, it's unity in contrast to disunity, the fear of the fighting among within Russia. Everybody came together. So then what's new, though, in the Putin era has been the sacralization of the person of Putin as the ruler. So World War II also works very nicely for his personality cult, because it's the cult of Stalin, the heroic Stalin, not the problematic Stalin. Lev Gutkov and Masha Lipman did a wonderful small book through Carnegie called The Stalin Puzzle. And through survey data, they showed that 50% of Russians view Stalin in a heroic light, while 63% view are cognizant of his... No, it's actually the other way. Sorry. 63% view him as heroic, and 50% view him as a criminal, authoritarian dictator. So that's the same population, which means that at least 13% are simultaneously viewing him as a dictator and as a heroic figure. So the what's a new element is this degree of creating loyalty versus disloyalty. The St. George's ribbons are a brand new creation. They're modeled on a czarist ribbon. I have a hunch, though I've never studied this, that they're also modeled on the U.S. Ribbons from the Gulf War, the yellow ribbons. They're the same shape, but they're orange and black, and they were introduced with a lot of fanfare. Putin has been talking a lot about memory lessons of young people meeting with the grandparents' generation. The other thing that's new is the way in which this war is highly mythologized within Soviet education, while the rest of Russian education is not as mythologized as Soviet education was. Soviet education was mythologized from every single period going back to Kievan Rus. Tsarist Russia was evil versus modern Soviet Russia, which was great. They've not re-mythologized yet all of Russian history, but they've certainly highly mythologized this war. And then in the last year, since 2011, it are the new rules on banning any criticism of the Red Army, banning Nazi insignia. It used to be that in Soviet times, people played with Wehrmacht toys and you know, had the way Americans would have cowboys versus Indians in the 1950s. In the 1950s, more like 1960s and 70s, Soviet kids played Nazi soldiers versus Russian soldiers. Now, if you have Nazi insignia, even on, you know, a toy, the store can be, you know, there can be a lawsuit. So, but then the other thing that I think is particularly dangerous in the 2014 context has been this question of painting the Kiev government as Nazis. So everybody who's against Russia must be fascists, must be Nazis.
This kind of goes back to my thing about historical trauma, in the sense that this kind of repetition of the war, like the, especially in regard to Ukraine, the rhetoric and the propaganda, at least toward the revolution in Ukraine, has been this kind of attempt to reenact, at least rhetorically, the war in many respects, to use these terms like fascist, to use Bandera and all of this stuff. And it seems to somewhat have some sort of resonance in Russian society to some extent.
I think it does. And I think why it's important is that, in fact, if we look at the generations, the generation that is most involved in the fighting in eastern Ukraine are the leaders, especially, were born in the 1970s. What that means is they came of age in 1991, 1992. So they had a happy Soviet childhood. Then they experienced the trauma of 1991 to 1999. They look back not to their parents, who they feel were failures, they didn't work. They look to their grandparents. This is a classic immigration phenomenon, that people idealize the language and the experience of the grandparents. So the generations that are interested in particularly in the fighting, are the youngest generation who did not experience World War II but have heard about it in mythological form, and of course the oldest generation who have held on to those memories and look to themselves as the, you know, having, you know, the greatest generation. It's an anomaly in a way in the U.S. that we've lost that heroic sense of World War II. I think that's part of the problem, is that we fail to understand how much the Russians suffered, how much the Soviets suffered, etc. But there's a hope that by bringing together this mythic re-celebration, it restores Russia's place in the world as a great nation. The Night Wolves have been trying to reenact a ride to Berlin to reenact May 9th. These are the biker gang, or biker group. I shouldn't use a disparaging term. But it's tricky to see that tension over what this war means.
You alluded to this idea of competing narratives about the Soviet role in World War II and how different societies, America has its narrative, Eastern Europe has its own narrative, Europe has its narrative, and of course Russia has its narrative. But let's talk about it in terms of kind of the American narrative versus the Russian narrative. And maybe you can touch on the different narratives with Eastern Europe in terms of like Ukraine or Poland too. But what are some of the blind spots of each of these narratives? I mean, you already alluded to the American reluctance or even inability to really understand the gravity of the war in the Russian sense. But nonetheless, what are some of the blind spots?
Well, you know, one of the things I always try to think about is what are the dates of this war, right? Both the U.S. and the USSR and now Russia describe this war as 1941 to 1945. But in fact, as any historian knows, and most people know if they think about it, the war actually began on September 1st, 1939, with the German invasion of Poland, followed 2 weeks later by the Soviet invasion of Poland. So from a Polish perspective, the war begins in 1939. It doesn't begin in 1941 at all. So to say that the war begins in 1941 is to make the war only about the suffering of one's own nation. So for the U.S., it's December 1941. For the Soviets, it's June of 1941, but that's not even a full picture of what this war is about. And we can even go back before that. But by starting in 1941 to 45, it ignores the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which the Nazi-Soviet Pact, when the Soviet Union created a treaty with the Nazis that allowed them to expand, to develop their armed forces, to move into Poland. And then for the Soviets also to move into Poland. So I think that means that for all of Eastern Europe, this is going to be an utterly different war from the Soviet version of the war. So we start with that blind spot. The next blind spot, of course, is the degree to which the Soviets were caught in a very bad position because of Stalin's terror against the military in 1939. He destroyed three quarters of the top leadership, the marshals and generals of his own army, so that they were caught without the right leadership. And he had his troops and especially his aircraft mobilized on the German frontier, and ignored warnings of what the Soviets were doing, of what the Nazis were doing, and so he lost a great deal of forces there. From the Russian perspective today, that looks like another source of suffering. So I understand why they don't particularly want to talk about it, but as soon as you mythologize it, then you're not looking at all the nuances of what happened. And the other thing, of course, that gets ignored from the Russian perspective is the degree that which Stalin, in part, under the cover of the war, or in response to the war, deported all the many nationalities from the Caucasus, Northern Caucasus region. So there's a lot of suffering that went in under the cover of the war. I mean, I don't think Russians today are even talking very much about the death penalties for deserters, the units that were behind the troops. There's just a lot of suffering that made that a particularly... It's as if all 27 million dead were killed by the West, but in fact only 8 million of the dead were military. Another 19 million were civilians. Some, and so the suffering of the war is a complicated thing. And from the Western perspective, there's a tendency to crow about D-Day in Normandy, which was technically a very big event, but it happened on June 6, 1944, when the tide of the war had already turned. The Soviets had already defeated the Nazis in Stalingrad. So there's a sense of American blindness to the sheer scale of the war for the Soviets and the Russians. And I think that blindness is very much of a problem. If we want to understand why this war is so important, we need to understand both the suffering and the magnitude of the war from the Russian perspective.
It's clear that, I mean, there's a lot of politics involved in how, you know, different nations understand the war, how it's memorialized. And I think we see that this politicization even taking another step recently, And the fact that so many Western leaders who have been invited to this 70th anniversary parade have declined. What's the significance of this act of declining these invitations? What message does it send?
Well, on the one hand, the foreign leaders haven't always attended the May 9th celebrations by any means. So we have to remember that that's part of the story. The 70th anniversary means much more for the Russians than it does for the West, I think. They've made a point of celebrating the 60th, the 61st, 62nd, and then, but each of the round dates is a big date. But the other tension, of course, is that the Western leaders have not had very many ways to symbolically say to the Russians, we don't approve of what's happened in Crimea and Ukraine. They've put in sanctions, they've tried to bring the Russians to the table in Minsk, and now I think, I'm not in the headquarters in Germany or in France or in the U.S., but I think they're trying to say, we're not going to come to your parade because we don't approve of your actions in Crimea and Ukraine. And I think since there are few ways to say we don't approve, that becomes a legitimate message. The challenge is that within Russia, of course, it's perceived as a severe snub. They've tried to reach out to Kim Jong-un, they've tried in from North Korea, they've tried to reach out to other leaders, but they wanted this to be a world May 9th. And Putin has a new tank he's going to show. They're going to show, they have 16,000 soldiers and 200 aircraft. And so they really wanted this to be a big symbolic event. And it's definitely a source of tension.
I mean, definitely, I agree with you. I mean, the few things that Western leaders could do, at least in a symbolic sense, and really symbolism is almost all they have left, is to kind of do this act of declining these this invitation, especially since the relationship of the war, the memory of the war, and the rhetoric that's been used to describe the conflict in Ukraine on the Russian side. I mean, to attend this parade, one could argue that it's basically giving legitimacy to the Russian position.
Yes. But the flip side is there's a degree to which the Russians have felt, and here's why I bring in that second trauma of 1991. Since they've felt that for them the breakup of the Soviet Union is a trauma, for the United States especially to have crowed about the end of communism, it sounds like code for the end of the Soviet Union. And they're so ambivalent about that then it spills over to, wait, why don't you understand our part in the war? And I think, you know, the sad thing is that the not understanding each other about the war began almost immediately. The Soviets did not want to make a talk about Lend-Lease. That is a subject not mentioned much in Russia. Or if it's mentioned, it's mentioned that as if the U.S. gave military assistance so that U.S. soldiers wouldn't have to die, so that it would be only Russian soldiers who died. From the U.S. perspective, it was an act of unparalleled generosity in American history. So that's the other big tension is over the U.S. assistance to the Soviets at the time was a recognition of how difficult this war was. But then almost immediately after the war, you get the tension over Berlin, the tension over Eastern Europe, and that goodwill disappears, creating a vacuum and a big problem. A colleague of mine here in Boston, Esther Kingston Mann, has done a study with her students reading news coverage from that time, from 46, 47, 48. And during the war, the U.S. coverage of Russians, of Soviets, and they were often called just Russians back then, always emphasizes the meeting at Potsdam, the meeting on the Elbe, shaking hands, handsome Soviet soldiers. Within 3 years, the coverage of Soviets refers to the destruction of Eastern Europe, but also rapes and chaos in Eastern Europe. And there's a kind of Mongolization of the Soviets, where they're shown as if they were Mongol invaders. And I don't mean any disrespect to modern Mongolians or even historic Mongolians, but in the mythography of the time, Mongols, of course, were the invaders, the cruel invaders. So you get this split, and so it's been a tension that goes way back, and it quite died down in my memory anyway in the 1990s and 2000s because nobody was early 2000s nobody was concerned with World War II, but then Putin brings back in World War II, I think, because he doesn't have very many other unifying myths, as you started to say, and I completely agree. He didn't have other holidays to work with. There were all these holidays he couldn't work with. So I think that's to understand that this relationship has been fraught over this topic on and off since the event itself.
So we've talked a lot about how the myth of the war has been utilized and crafted on an official level. But what about the popular memory of the war? What can we say about that, and how much does it coincide and deviate from official memorialization?
My sense is that Russians really perceive it as a benign holiday, in the sense that, you know, if you ask Americans about democracy and apple pie, everybody's in favor of them. Why wouldn't you be in favor of memorialization of Soviet suffering and Soviet heroism? Because there isn't discussion of the dark sides of the war, there isn't discussion of the foreign assistance, the role of other people, I think that there's actually quite a fair congruence between the official version of the war and the popular version of the war. I often say to my students that the reason democracy is so popular in the U.S. is because that was the hot idea in the 18th century when the country was founded. Well, Russia is trying to refound itself. They can't do 1917 because there's a communist party and Putin and the current leadership are not in that party, and they don't want to bring back the full Soviet set of events. There aren't Tsarist holidays to bring back. They're bringing back the Orthodox Church. But the holiday that brings military might, sacred relations within the nation, that is really World War II.
I agree. I mean, in terms of back to this idea of unification, there has been kind of some dabbling in kind of memorializing certain, you know, Tsarist figures. I mean, one thinks of like Stolypin, for example. There's been some kind of playing with a little bit of the Soviet period, but not that much. But really, the war is the one holiday that seems to bring everyone together because of this kind of collective suffering and collective memory and collective might that it shows.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, they put in a Unity Day on November 4th, if you remember, in the early 2000s. I think that, I'm not sure, that might still exist. The June 12th Russia Day has definitely been taken off the books. December 12th Constitution Day isn't being celebrated this year. So, you know, May 1st Labor Day, well, that's again a communist holiday. But then what they've brought back in is February 23rd, which is the Red Army Day, now renamed, I forgot exactly what. So you've got a men's holiday on February 23rd and a women's holiday on March 8th. What's very interesting for a historian is, of course, that February 23rd was actually the February Revolution, which was taken out of the Soviet canon of holidays almost immediately. The Red Army was founded on January 15th. It wasn't founded on February 23rd at all. They needed a holiday, though, on February 23rd to upstage the February Revolution. So anyway, what May 9th does is it's a perfect time of year. It's a longstanding holiday since the Brezhnev years, and as I say, it allows this parade, this ritual, this sense of belonging, this national unity. It avoids the issues of what happened to all the Central Asian nations, the Ukraine. Ukraine and Russia were recently, Vladimir Putin handed out a set of medals to some of the veterans on the, and he did it to the background of flags, you know, banners that said the first Ukrainian front, the second Ukrainian front, the third Ukrainian front. And the reason for doing this was, of course, that those veterans fought on those fronts. But it's to show, again, this was the Ukrainian front was the Soviet front. There was no distinction between Ukrainian and Russian. Ukrainian and Russian were on paper. So that greater Russia, greater Soviet geography is also part of the story.
And finally, I mean, you've mentioned this already, but what's interesting that at least from what I've noticed over the last couple of years, there's an increasing sacralization of the holiday and its symbols. And you mentioned this already, but I'd like to go into it more because in the last month or so, we've seen several kind of small scandals kind of erupting in the Russian press, involving the desecration of the war's memory. How do you explain this kind of wave of Russian political correctness?
Well, I think it is very interesting that they always like certain kinds of political correctness, and then they don't like other kinds of political correctness. What the war does, political correctness around the war does, is it, of course, creates an us versus a them. It ignores the fact that right-wing European leaders have been meeting in Moscow. It ignores that Marine Le Pen has spoken to the Russian Duma. It puts all of the Nazis, the fascists on the Ukrainian side, the Ukrainian government side. It creates a, you know, Crimea is ours versus Western Ukraine, which doesn't understand us. So I think it's trying to clamp down on pluralism around the war as a place of unification. So they've created agencies like Rospatriotcentr, or Ros, which means the Russian Patriotic Center. It's a Russian Patriotic Center for civic and youth education. Putin's been talking about that for years, actually. He's got patriotic education institutions around the country, particularly, let it be noted, for boys. He has only one or two that even have any girls. So there's a cult of boys fighting, carrying flags, but they have to be the right ones. You can't have a diversity of flags. There's new organizations on, you know, Россотрудничество, you know, Russian cooperation, and you know, they're really struggling with how to get everybody on the same message and not have anybody espousing anti-Russian views. And Russia has had its problems with it. Like almost all the modern nations, it has its neo-Nazi movement, it has its fascists and its skinheads. So I think this is also a way of saying there's one kind of nationalism, and we're not going to go to the extreme nationalisms, which, as I, you know, one of the things that's interesting for historians is that this tension over how big is Russia? Is Russia just the nation of Russia as it is today? Well, even that is multinational. Or is it what we call the Commonwealth of Independent States? Is it the Eurasian Union? So by creating those scandals over swastikas, it's really creating a correct nationalism that is centrist and non-extremist.
That was Elizabeth Wood, a professor of history at MIT and author of Performing Justice, Agitation Trials in Early Soviet Russia. I'm Sean Guillory, and this is the SRB podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and follow me on Twitter at Sean's Russia Blog. Until next week, bye.
Моя Марусечка, моя ты куколка, моя Марусечка, моя ты душенька, моя Марусечка, а жить-то хочется, я весь горю тебя, молю, будь моей женой.